welcome to this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, hosted by Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Rear, and for the purposes of this intro, I'm joined once again by Mr. David Holmes and producer Miles. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Hello, Ollie.
How are we both doing?
Yeah, not so bad. Not so bad. Busy week, but getting there slowly.
Yeah, getting pretty good. Seemed like it was a great session today, yeah, so in a good mood.
Thanks for bringing up the session, Miles, and not just talking about your week generally. Dave. I mean, I know that we're about to go into a heat wave, Dave, but we do still need to brief the listeners on what we were talking about today, particularly as we've just come off of what I thought was a really, really excellent conversation. I really, really very much enjoyed that. We were joined this week by a very special guest, a long-time contributor to DPP generally. That's Colin Sales, CEO of 3C Consultants. And we had our conversation all about data excellence, data accuracy, specifically data quality, didn't we, Dave? I mean, ultimately, Colin and the guys at 3C, their bag is specifically, in this instance, the housing sector. But if you're not in that sector, don't worry. There's plenty to take away from this. And there's a lot of crossover that happens. But ultimately, their bag is information, right? It's information governance. It's the quality of that information, the accuracy of it, and the value that you can draw from that. But also the drawbacks of not being quite so hot on it, Dave.
Yeah, I was going to say it's the value of the information I think they're really drawing on. I mean, the accuracy of information is fine, but it's the value of it, isn't it? And that's kind of the underpinning bit behind accuracy for them, is what you can actually do with it and the purposes of ensuring it's accurate so you can rely on it.
Exactly. And it was absolutely fantastic to talk to Colin. He's a very, very, very knowledgeable guy. He speaks very well. There was a point where I could barely get a word in edgeways, wasn't there, Dave? You two had quite the conversation for a couple minutes there.
Yeah, yeah. I must apologise. I took over for a little bit, but I realised I was taking the seat of Ollie far too much, and I quickly handed it back.
That's quite all right. As you said on the podcast, you're getting used to doing it without me, so clearly I'll be redundant soon enough, and it'll just be the Dave show. Soapbox.
That'll be a spin-off, but we won't replace you.
Okay, good. Well, yeah, as we say, it was a really fascinating conversation. We spoke all about some of the, you know, ways in which you can really sort of improve the quality of the data that you are handling, the information that you handle, how you can, you know, really sort of drive that change within the organization about collecting good information. And ultimately, we did actually, contrary to what sometimes happens on our podcast, we did actually get to the key title of this conversation, which was the 3 golden rules for data excellence. And we did cover all those. I'm not going to tell you what those are now, because otherwise there's no point in you going and listening to the rest of the conversation. But we worked through them, didn't we, Dave? And some really good learning to be taken away from that, I think, broadly speaking.
Absolutely. I know we say it was interesting every week, but I really took a lot from this, because I've got a kind of keen interest in data quality and data accuracy from a hat I was wearing many moons ago when I was working in direct marketing. So I fully understand and have seen the benefits of accurate data, and have had sleepless nights from inaccurate data as well. So it's really ticked a lot of boxes for myself.
Yeah, and I think what's really, really comes out of all of this is that this is something which is not going anywhere. If anything, it's simply going to accelerate and become even more of an important issue, and it's going to become talked about even more within the housing sector in particular, but also more widely. I think a lot of us are sort of, you mentioned, Dave, in the main body of the session, but you mentioned that a lot of us perhaps are lagging behind analytics and direct marketing, perhaps, in terms of the value of data. But I think we're getting there, and that's one of the things that Colin is confident about, is, you know, he's saying basically watch this space, it's happening now. So really, really fascinating. There's loads in there to talk about. We will be back next week with another episode of GDPR Radio, so all the news items that have come out this week, and there have been a couple, don't worry, we've been paying attention for once. All of those news items, our views on that, bits and pieces, opinion pieces, we will be back next week with that episode of GDPR Radio to discuss all of that. If there's anything you want us to cover in the meantime obviously just get in touch with us. We've stopped asking for feedback and reviews over the past few weeks. It's sort of dropped off our radar a bit, but please don't get us wrong. Those are still incredibly valuable to us. If you enjoy this podcast, then do feel free to leave us a review or write in, get in touch, tell us how we can improve things, maybe things you like, the things you don't like. We got some correspondence recently from one of our listeners who challenged me on something, and we've had a really good conversation about it. I'll probably provide an update to the listeners on that next week when I've had a chance to finalize my thoughts. But, you know, really valuable interaction and something we greatly appreciate. On that note, I've probably waffled enough. Dave, Miles, anything else that you two want to cover off before we let the listeners get stuck into it?
I think I'm good. I think you've touched all the bases there, and I'm more than happy to let them jump in and enjoy the discussion with Colin.
Excellent. Well, on that note, I shall leave you, listener, to get stuck into this conversation all about data excellence with Colin Sales, and we'll catch up with you very soon. So as I mentioned, today we're talking data accuracy. More specifically, we're talking data excellence. Three golden rules for data excellence. And as I say, we're joined by Colin here. Colin, would you mind, just to get us started, giving us a bit of an introduction to who you are, telling us a little bit about 3C and what you do?
Okay, so as you've already said, I'm the CEO of 3C. 3C are one of the largest providers of IT consultancy in the social housing sector, and we've got customers literally all over the UK and Ireland. Looking at my kind of background, 3C is actually my third business, and my two previous businesses both had financial backing. And by that, I mean we had to produce reports every month to say how we were doing and if there was any inaccuracy in those reports, or if our performance looked a bit dodgy. As directors of those businesses, we could be in a lot of trouble. So I learned very early on that data and the accuracy of data was hugely important. Also, I'm fairly keen on thought leadership within this sector, the social housing sector, and although I appreciate some of you may be from outside that sector, but certainly within the sector, we're just really beginning to go on our journey with data. I've led a couple of groups. One is the data quality group, which had people like Hacked and Housemark and various others who are kind of seen as thought leaders in data quality to try and create some kind of gold standard for the sector. I'm part of a group called the IT Good Governance Group, which again is all about using information in order to ensure that as organizations we're aligned with the NHF Code of Governance. I lead a group called the 540 Group, which is the organizations implementing dynamics, and that group has very much accepted that getting data right and accurate is absolutely fundamental to transformation of systems from one legacy system to something new. So data is very much at the heart of my thinking currently, and hope I can add some value today.
You most certainly can. Now, as you mentioned there, obviously, you guys are focused primarily on the housing sector, but this is by no means a session exclusively for the housing sector. What we always find when we go and look at sector-specific environments is that there's always elements of learning that will be shared outside of that sector. There's always value to be found. So if you are seeing common themes across what we're discussing in a sector that is unrelated to housing, then, you know, do shout up in the chat. There's always plenty to be discussed. So I don't know, Dave, if you've got any questions to start us off, but I thought it was probably worth starting with the idea that, I mean, the session is called Three Golden Rules for Data Excellence, but probably looking at what we mean by excellence and why perhaps we're conflating that with accuracy. We spend a lot of time talking about personal data and GDPR compliance generally, don't we, Dave? And obviously accuracy is a key element of that. We've often spoken about it, haven't we?
We do, and it's obviously relates to one of the key principles under the GDPR. But I'm also mindful Partly picking up on what Colin mentioned in his introduction, and also from my background. And I've got a real keen interest in data accuracy from a background when I used to work in direct marketing and understanding donor journeys and understanding why people do stuff and why they don't do stuff. And all that heavily relates on accurate personal data. But when we're looking at data accuracy, at some point we maybe need to think slightly wider. There's still financial accuracy of recording of data and so on and so forth. So we maybe will look around or have some discussions kind of predominantly around making sure personal data is accurate. But the organization uses a lot more information than just personal information, and the accuracy of that information as well will be of interest, no doubt, to someone to see whether the accuracy principles and the data excellence also covers those elements as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I think at this point, I mean, it should be relatively self-evident why we are equating, you know, good, strong, accurate data, whether it's, as you mentioned, Dave, personal data, or more broadly information that an organization handles, with this idea of excellence. But Colin, I wondered maybe if you could, before we get into those three golden rules, whether you could maybe talk a little bit around your experience with maybe some of the cases that you've come across where really you've seen drastic improvement perhaps in the practices around the handling of information, around the quality of information being handled, some of the knock-on effects of that perhaps, and conversely maybe instances where you've had or seen slightly less successful instances and perhaps the issues that may come with that. I appreciate it's a broad question, but I'm sure you will have seen your fair share of horror stories and also, you know, success stories across the sector.
No, absolutely. I mean, there are. I need to be a little bit careful with the horror stories, and because there are some horrendous ones, some of which have kind of led to the wholesale change of senior management teams within social housing. You know, some of them have been quite literally life and death, all because of poor data. And so if you were to look at what bad looks like, I would say, you know, that there is some horrific examples out there of how poor data has led to people losing their lives. And these are very current. This isn't, you know, we all know the things like Grenfell. I know there are people who are on this session today whose organizations have been, or organizations they once worked for, have been absolutely catastrophically changed as a result of poor information leading to problems. So that's what bad looks like. I probably just refer to the government here, because of course Boris Johnson is currently experiencing what accuracy of data can lead to. And the government had brought out this new saying this year, specifically aimed at the NHF, but wider, and that was data is the new air. And what that's kind of saying is that, you know, let's get real here. If you know, it used to be data is the new oil, and oil was the most valuable commodity of the 20th century, and they thought that data was going to be the most valuable commodity in the 21st century. But they've changed that now to data is the new air. And the reason they've done that is that oil is something you can survive without, just about. Air, you can't. It's absolutely fundamental. So so you've got this shift in emphasis at the moment, that everyone's beginning to come to terms with those who treat data properly, who appreciate what the quality of information can do for their organizations in providing insight and better working practices, etc., what it can do for them. And as a result of that, where I see good within organizations, those are the organizations where the meaning of IT is changing. So probably if I asked a lot of you what you thought, you know, when you thought of IT, what do you think about? You might say computers, you might say your networks and software and things like that. But of course, that's because the T has kind of absolutely overtaken the meaning of IT. IT means information technology. And what we're seeing is a shift now from the T to the I. So where Where I see good, you see organizations putting their focus on information and the technology purely being the enabler of that, rather than the, if you like, the primary focus. So it's that meaning of IT that, that's changing, and also that having the support from the very top. And we'll come back to that in a minute, because that's fundamental really to accurate information and the use of it and the culture change, etc., that we'll come onto, is that kind of leadership angle. So I don't know if that answers your question.
It's quite interesting. Sorry, Ola, I was just going to jump in. It's quite interesting because from a marketing point, the power of data has been understood for a long time from a direct marketing point. Do you think the social housing sector is slowly coming around to understanding the power of data from business insight and that kind of thing, and kind of playing a little bit of catch up? Or is there, because I get the fundamental shift from the technology bit to the info bit, or the information bit in that sense. But my, like I said, my background, if the information wasn't right, then from indirect marketing elements, then it had big problems, as you probably quite well imagine, that kind of thing. So marketing and direct marketing for many years has been really focused on accurate data for segmentation and understanding. Do you think the social housing is slightly behind that? Do you think there's kind of a move to kind of understand that now?
I hate to say it, I think they're very behind, certainly behind the leaders. And a great example of that is that it's one of the few sectors where there isn't a marketing department, or rarely. You know, the sector tends to think of marketing as something that goes on elsewhere in other sectors. They will focus on customer communication, but without necessarily appreciating that is marketing. Marketing puts a more commercial kind of force behind customer communication and the value of it. And I think the sector's lagged behind, and it potentially it is the use of such words like creating marketing teams and within social housing providers that could be part of that shift. Putting the customer at the heart of everything is really what everyone agrees they needed to do. But when you're thinking of it from a marketing perspective, you're trying to sell yourself to the customer. And I think that's something that's lacked within the sector, but it's something that is now being recognised. So, yeah, I think things are starting to change.
For sure. Sorry, yeah. I'll pass back to you. I appreciate I jumped in there, but
that's quite all right.
I've seen the power of data if you get it right, and therefore once you've understand the power of data, what it can do organisationally, your focus then shifts on making sure it is absolutely accurate. Because anything else will water down the effects of that. So anyway, back to you, Ollie. Sorry for jumping.
No, of course. No, that's perfectly fine. Don't you worry. All I was going to come in with was, you know, Colin was mentioning there some of the negative consequences of having inaccurate data. And all I was going to do was come in with a couple of some lighthearted examples, some slightly lesser, but that we've seen and discussed on previous podcasts. So some people may remember a news story from towards the start of the pandemic where and again, this is where we can talk about the cross-sector application of what we're discussing here. But, you know, we saw instances where certain people were being called forward for their vaccine as part of a, you know, the first priority, most vulnerable patients. And they didn't understand why until they got to the practice and realized that their records were incorrect and their weight and height had been incorrectly recorded. And they had a BMI that was well, frankly, impossible, but a huge, huge BMI. And as a result of that, they were deemed to be high priority. I had something similar the other day. I went to my GP and they said, well, your record indicates that you're 180 kilos, but that doesn't seem quite right. I assume that's been incorrectly recorded. And, well, some of you haven't seen me before, but those of you who know me in person probably know that that's not quite right. And, you know, while that can be sort of a bit lighthearted and a bit of a joke, we even had instances where we had colleagues from the healthcare sector on a past episode telling us that one of the number one causes of issues in the NHS with a clinical outcome are accuracy issues, in that sometimes you would have patients coming in and they'd be due an x-ray on their right arm, and because it's incorrectly recorded they end up having an x-ray on the left arm. And again, while that's maybe not the biggest impact, it does have a knock-on effect, and I'm sure Colin you can tell us more about the sort of knock-on effect of this type of thing that you will have seen. But within the housing sector specifically, but you're talking about a cost associated with that, you're talking about time associated with that, resources, and potentially even in that case, clinical outcomes, or from the housing perspective, you might be talking about regulatory outcomes even potentially. I'm sure we'll get to talk about that in a little bit, but it was just to add in there, you know, some of those examples, maybe not quite so extreme, but still, it's important to think about the knock-on effect always.
Another example, which is quite common out there, and it's just due to just not controlling data properly or updating it properly, is the amount of correspondence that is sent to dead people. Yes. It's rather morbid, but you know, it can be quite upsetting for relatives when information is being sent to people that are no longer with us, and yet it's quite commonplace out there, and you hear about it a fair amount. If you were to look at most organizations' databases, you will find that being a problem, and yet it's quite easily corrected.
So when we look at data accuracy, and let's say I've come to you, Colin, and said, look, my data's a mess. We need to get better with data accuracy. Where would I actually start? Because I think there's going to be many factors into data accuracy, and what you could kind of look to help kind of manage and govern accuracy. It's not just going to be a light switch element. There's going to be multitudes of things that will feed into the accuracy, or what may be accurate and then becoming inaccurate through lack of controls and some of the lack of the controls. But where would I start? If I kind of go, well, I know my data is a mess, it needs cleaning up, where would I actually start?
So I'm a little bit biased here, because for me, you cannot really get a handle on your data unless you start using some of the modern tools that are available that automate the process and provide you with the information and support that you need to ensure you have accurate data. And very, very importantly as well, when it comes to being assessed, you know, by people like the regulator, you know, what we're increasingly seeing now is the call for proving it, because sometimes there's a distrust in the information. So how do you have confidence in the information you provide? And there are now tools out there. We use one called DataLogic that just help you to get your data in order. And don't let's underestimate the challenge. You know, this sector has some challenges. I think you're probably only all too familiar with the fact that we have very many different pieces of software that we use. These pieces of software don't talk to each other. I could not believe the number of spreadsheets that are absolutely tend to be fundamental for many organizations and hold information. And that's something we really need to try and move away from. So when you have these disparate bits of software, often that hold very similar information, I mean, you know, an asset management system and a housing management system will often hold the same kind of information. And yet you will often find that the information in the two doesn't agree. You need something. You need something that can get in there and create a single version of the truth that can allow you to assess the information you have across your different systems, provide you with a single, if you like, data warehouse that can be quite cost effectively put together compared to some other data warehouse type solutions that allow you to search, compare and manage data much more easily. These kind of solutions will also alert you if poor data enters the data estate. We kind of call that the dirty data tap and turning it off, because over the years, and we've been providing data services for well over 5 years now, you know, you go in and do a data quality audit for an organization, you get the data in a decent state, and then 6 months later, it would be, you know, back in a similar position as it was when you first started. They reckon that data can degrade around 25% a year. So, I mean, that's significant, and that you'll probably find that information. I think it's Gartmore or Forrester or someone like that who released that kind of information. So, so you need to get on top of it, and you need to have something that ultimately, if someone asks you to prove whether your your data is accurate, you can point at something tangible. And that is providing you with that assurance. And these kind of tools never sleep. They operate 24/7, and they just keep you posted should anything start to go wrong, and help you keep your data in order, regardless of how many different data bases you have. So I honestly believe that there's going to be a time when certainly as far as medium to large organization is concerned, not one of them will not have one of these tools. They will be fundamental to keeping your data in order and managing it properly.
So what was interesting there was kind of hinting toward culture. So you might have the systems in, but how would you change culture and people's attitudes to accuracy of data? Because as you mentioned, that they may download stuff, have their own file somewhere, and constantly draw on that instead of the single version of the truth. And I've seen it with CRM systems from a marketing point, where you'll get emails with telephone fields and all sorts of bits and pieces kind of going on. So how would you the tech might be there and you might be able to use that, but how would you change the culture towards data accuracy? For people inputting data and that kind of thing.
So this is one of the three golden rules, culture change. It's actually the third, so I've jumped to already. But but culture change is absolutely fundamental. And in my experience, it eats technology and information change for breakfast. So unless you can get the culture change bit right, then, you can just waste a huge amount of time and energy. And that culture change has to start at the top. So how do you convince those at the top that data should be fundamentally important to them, and indeed those at all levels within the organization? And the way I kind of look at it is you've got to make it relevant. So you've got to ask yourself the question for each individual, what's in it for them? And then carrot and stick, what are the consequences if they don't conform or they don't value the data? I've used it a few times. Who was the guy? Charles Darwin, who said, in his, I can't remember the name of the book either. There's something of the species. Anyway, he said that it's not the strongest species that survive, and it's not the most intelligent, but it's those that are most responsive to change. So how do you make people responsive to change? And I come back to it. And much of the time, it's what's in it for them. So the way I look at it is that if you look at what motivates people, a lot of people think it's money. Fortunately, it's not money. Money is a motivator for a short period of time. But in my experience, people are motivated by money for about 4 or 5 weeks, and they think it's great, and then it just happens to be the money they're on. So giving people more money is important sometimes, but it's not a great motivator. The four key motivators are the environment people work in, recognition. Do they feel recognized in their work? Do they feel like they're being developed as an individual? And do they feel secure in what they do? So if we look at those for a minute, number one, what's in it for me from an environmental perspective? Well, if you feel empowered, if you feel that the work you're doing is based on fact, and therefore you can make decisions, and you can feel that what you are doing is right, should you be challenged, then you have a great working environment, particularly when also it builds a culture and the people around you are also confident in what they do and say. So it's empowering everybody and making them feel like they can make a difference. Then from a recognition point of view, of course, if you are monitoring, measuring information and performance for the individual, then you're much better at being able to let them know when they're doing well and and also indeed when they need a little bit of help and support and development. So these are all fairly fundamental. And then when it comes to security, come back to it. You know, the security of an organization is based on the information that it provides and it being accurate in many cases. Social housing sector tends to have lacked a burning platform a little bit from that perspective. But the regulator, as I say, is becoming more and more focused on data. And as a consequence, I think it's partially that that's driving this new interest, if you like, or new interest, growing interest in data quality. So, culture change for me is all about, you know, what's in it for me. And then there is the kind of stick side as well. What are the consequences if I don't conform? I come back to these tools again. If you introduce these tools, which tells you when poor data is entering the data estate, it will tell you where and who is doing it. And, you know, like any form of training, you remember 75% of it, and maybe over time it degrades to 50%. So people find workarounds, people find little shortcuts, they get into bad habits. And the job is to spot when that's happening and being able to then go to that individual and say, look, you know, can I get you back on track here? If someone is continually doing it, then that's a real problem and it needs to be addressed and there needs to be consequences. So much about data quality is about accountability and having the right tools in place to spot when things are going wrong so you can hold people accountable for it. And, you know, let's face it, if you are constantly being pulled up on something, you are probably going to do something about it. So for me, culture change is all about making it relevant to the individual and then putting the tools in place to ensure that you can enforce it.
For sure. And again, you'd be suggesting that starts from the top, from
absolutely
the development down. Because I've always come from the basis that information is an asset and you need to invest in the asset for it to maintain its value. Otherwise, like any asset, otherwise it will depreciate. And the value dissipates over time, just as you've indicated there. So it's really interesting from a cultural point, because I think many of us, I was certainly reflecting on some of those areas you were talking. I know you were specifically focusing around data accuracy, but generally, how would you change culture within an organisation to governance, for example, or to compliance in whichever field you're looking from a compliance point?
Could I catch just one last point before we move on to compliance? Because obviously that's a hugely important part. Over the years, I've sat around many boardroom tables, and I can tell you that probably some of the most stressful points in my career have been associated with trying to get a decision based on information that I'm not confident in, and I know the people I'm trying to convince are not confident in either. That's a huge amount of stress over the years. If I know the information that I'm basing decisions upon or requesting approval upon is correct, it makes me hugely more confident in what I'm trying to achieve, and it makes my job a tremendous amount easier. So as a senior executive, you know, and you're dealing with your reputation around a boardroom table, you know, the accuracy of information is critical.
And is that just the measures you've spoken about then in order to get confidence in the accuracy? Would you have, is it just technology? How would you measure in order to get that confidence in that sense? So you knew the information was accurate in order to rely on it and to make better business decisions. How would you get confidence or assurance that the information is accurate?
So possibly this is a good time for me to come back to the compliance we were moving on to then.
Yes.
Is to refer to what the regulator is now saying, and within the local sector risk profile of 2021, there is a whole section there now dedicated to data, and one of the areas of that is 3.28 which says boards must have assurance that data integrity is appropriately managed, including ensuring adequate quality controls and robust audit trails are in place. Identifying critical data and information asset owners, establishing process maps and implementing appropriate software solutions such as error detection. So that's written down within the sector risk profile, and that is what organizations are going to be judged upon from a regulatory point of view. Now, I know, for instance, DPP have DataWise, which is a method of managing and controlling and recording data management within an organization. So tools like that are absolutely critical. Datalogic, which I've already mentioned, the automated data kind of one of the automated data quality solutions is also critical to it. So it's these kind of things that can help you to assess your information, to manage it and monitor the quality and the management of information going forward. And you can just imagine if you were a regulator and you were coming in and assessing that your confidence in the quality of information within an organization, and you saw tools like this in use, then not only would you be able to tick the big box that you have implemented appropriate software solutions such as error detection, but you would also provide them with the confidence that the information you were providing was accurate.
For sure. And just before I hand back to Ollie, otherwise it looks like we're sidelining any questions that Ollie's got. And it sounds like it might sound silly initially, but when we're talking about data accuracy, how accurate does data have to be for it to be deemed accurate in that sense? Is it 100%, it's either right or it's wrong? Is it binary? Or is there a little bit of, well, actually accuracy is based around about 90%, 95%, that kind of thing?
The answer to that is it all depends on what the data is. If the data is life and death, I would suggest to you that it has to be 100% accurate. If it's whether someone's a Mr. or a Master or a Mrs. or a whatever it might be, then of course, you could argue 75% accuracy is fine. You may not. You may want 90, 95. But there is a cost associated with this. There is time that it takes to do it. And what I would suggest is that if you look at the information you have, you give it maybe a traffic light system. So you have, I know this is something one of our customers at Westwood do very well. You know, that data which is critical, for which there can be no inaccuracy, that's scored red as critical. And then the amber, that which is considered to be very important, and which maybe you want at least 95% accuracy, if not more. And then you have the green, which is maybe not so accurate, or where it's not so essentially important. It won't be so embarrassing. It won't be so critical. It won't cost lives should you get it wrong. So if you want to know where to start and prioritize, I would suggest that that's the way.
So kind of a risk-based, what's the most serious data that must be 100% accurate, and then build your tolerances as you work through your data sets, potentially kind of as you just indicated there. If you've got lower value, lower risk, or information of a lower importance, you may have greater tolerances to the level of accuracy. But if it's really fundamental and really critical that it's 100% accurate, then nothing less will be acceptable in that sense.
Well, the ones I can tell you are treated very, very sensitively is gas boiler certification. So, you know, have all your gas boilers been checked? And if they haven't, then that could be life and death. I mentioned a social housing provider, quite a major one, that had wholesale change of their senior management team. And I believe that was associated with, not maintaining lifts within apartment blocks properly, which led to serious problem. So I come back to it tends to be those that information that could potentially be life impacting, and those are two examples, if you like, of of what that could be.
No, for sure, for sure. I'll have to hand back to Ollie, otherwise it looks like we're sidelining right. any questions that Ollie might have. So I do apologise for that. I've taken over slightly there, Ollie.
Don't you worry, don't you worry. As regular listeners know, these are my favourite sessions where I don't have to do quite so much of the talking. I can enjoy and just sit back and listen to you both. But I was really interested in sort of that last point where you're talking about effectively applying a risk-based approach to classification, ultimately, is what it is. And, you know, the potential that you would have to align that both with your wider risk management processes. I think that's something which is theoretically very appealing to be able to fold that in. Potentially, although it's maybe not as straightforward, you know, there's a parallel there, as I say, with something like an information classification scheme, if you operate that sort of thing. So it's really interesting to hear you talk about that. Colin Bailey in the chat echoes what you were saying, which is introducing something like a weighting system based on the criticality of data in respect of their rules around quality. And the example, as you were saying it almost, that you mentioned, which is around gas servicing being amongst the highest, as you might expect. So I think it was very interesting to hear you talk about that. One of the things I did want to just quickly pick up on, because I think, I mean, we do need to get to your wider rules, because as far as I'm concerned, we've only really properly introduced one thus far, although you have mentioned another one in passing, I think. But one thing I did want to pick up on, we can maybe come back to it later, is about that regulatory approach to things, I think is really interesting. And we often talk about on this feed the potential for enforcement not to come from the ICO when we talk about personal data, but maybe to come from other regulators. And I think particularly if we're talking about the regulator of social housing, to see different approaches there might be really interesting, where there might be overlap and where there might be differences. One thing's, because you were talking about that in the context of specific applications, specific systems and programs, and this is one of the things which I think is interesting to see creep in also with the ICO, where, again, I'm slightly reaching a little bit, but we saw really strong statements from them in their last subject access guidance, where they were saying that, you know, it's all well and good having systems in place, but it's not an excuse to have poorly calibrated systems anymore. You can't say that you can't fulfill your obligations if your systems are poorly calibrated anymore. It simply won't wash. You have to be on top of these things. So I do think it's interesting to see the slight parallels there. I say we probably need to get on to your other rules, one of which you touched on very briefly, I suppose, which was about leading from the top. I know this is sort of effectively your key rule here. So I don't know if you wanted to tell us a little bit about that. I guess it's expanding on that previous point, which I did think was fascinating, because we talk a lot about culture within organisations and changing culture around information governance. But I suppose that this builds on it, really. And you mentioned really that you have to lead from the top, as you say.
Yeah, absolutely. In my view, if you don't have that support from the top, you will probably fail. At least that's our experience. I would actually go as far to say that if you have a transformation program and data transformation isn't a first step within that, your transformation program will fail as well. So it come back to it. When you're looking at your leadership team and the leadership of data within the business, you've got to again ask the question, you know, what's in it for them? Why would they want to start putting this at the forefront, and what's stopping them from doing it? And maybe let's just pause on what's stopping it as well, because I think it took me a while to realize why people just weren't embracing data at a senior level. And the reason seems to be, and I've had this from various very educated sources, is that there is a fear of data quality. You know, most organizations know that they've got a problem, and if they don't open Pandora's box and reveal the problems, then they can stick their head in the sand. And if they do open the box and they do find something serious, and that happened on their watch, then there is an argument to say, what impact might that have? you know, you talk about the ICO a moment ago, and the ICO says, you know, if you've had a data breach, you know, you've got 48 hours to come clean. You know, if you were to find out something very serious within your housing data, and this is information that you have signed off in previous years to say, yeah, no, I give you my assurance that this information is accurate, then the consequences could be significant. And if you've been reporting a number about your performance for some time, and then you suddenly realize that that number needs to be downgraded, well, maybe you don't want to do that. So there is this fear associated with what we might find if we really turn our minds to it. I actually discussed this with the regulator and said, well, could there be an amnesty period? And the response was, well, we can't, although that's not a bad idea, we can't sanction that, because if something very serious happened during that amnesty period, then our responsibility, we would be responsible for letting people off. So we can't be seen to do it. So so let's come back to, you know, how do you motivate that top team and get that leadership kind of behind you? Firstly, if you look at what are they discussing around the boardroom table, what are the really hot topics? And often when you look at these things, data doesn't immediately kind of sit there as being a priority. And yet, almost certainly, data literally underpins all of those different strategic goals. So what are the strategic goals within your organization, and how does data relate to those? So let's give you a few examples. So some of the hottest topics in social housing at the moment are the social housing white paper, putting the customer at the heart of everything, the NHF code of governance, making sure you're running your organization properly, post-COVID working practices, becoming more efficient in the way you operate and making sure you can work anywhere, anytime, any place. And of course, there's the new draft safety bill that's out. Again, that's all about keeping your customers and your tenants safe. And then you've also got data security. And, you know, we talk about some of the horror stories, and I'm sure DPP know more of these horror stories than I do. But we are seeing, I mean, Clarion at the moment, if you look at Inside Housing, have had elements of their system down for over 2 weeks because there's been a data attack. There have been ransomware within the sector. Housing associations, I can think of one that's paid out over £1 million as a result of damages associated with those things. So these are the topics that are being discussed around the boardroom table. And how do you make data relevant to them? One of the groups I told you I was involved with was the IT Code of Governance group. And that's because if you read the NHF Code of Governance, data is really hardly mentioned at all. And yet you look at every single point almost within the code, and it's all about data. So it's actually making that information important, that insight that data provides important. I mentioned to you also that you know, some of the most stressful times I've ever had has been sitting around the boardroom table with inaccurate information, or certainly information I wasn't confident in. So that's the kind of thing that makes it important. You know, accurate information underpins the security of the business. It's fundamental, I think, to job satisfaction and job security. It allows you to work faster, smarter, and more effectively. And importantly, you get it right, and it's got an enormous social benefit. You know, if you've got the data right, you'll protect your income streams, you'll provide better services, you'll make the working environment for yourself and your colleagues better, and most importantly, you will provide better social value. And you know what? You know, who wouldn't want to do that? Who wouldn't want to do it? But it's making it relevant to these individuals. You have also the risks associated with it, and you mentioned about the regulator. And if you look, you can go on the internet and you can have a look at this, because the downgrades are published online, and you look at those downgrades. And I would say, and we've done this, that in the vast majority of cases, over 90% of cases, you can relate the downgrade to poor information. So we're talking about people's reputations, we're talking about potentially their job security. If you don't sort out your data and ensure it's robust, then you're putting yourself at risk. And someone said to me once that the things do not get done unless you're going to get sacked, embarrassed, or fined. Now, I think that's a sad state of affairs, but yeah. I do understand that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the things that's probably really important to drive home here. And I suppose just to really sort of put the bow on it, but what you're saying is there's effectively very much the carrot and the stick here. There's incredible value to be taken from all of this. And arguably outweighing the potential, well, I don't know, maybe that's a conversation for a different day, but arguably you could even say that it outweighs the potential detriment of not getting on top of this. I think I was just going to make an additional point about regulatory action there, although I have to say that it's just escaped me, so I'll have to come back to that. But yeah, no, I do think, you know, it's probably really important to re-emphasize that you do have this dichotomy available. We've spent a lot of time, and this is potentially where there is a discrepancy between our specific field, Dave and mine, which is, you know, data protection, privacy, etc., and more broadly information governance. And when you're talking about the quality of data, Colin, is that you do have more of an incentive to pursue it. I think that's something which perhaps we, as privacy professionals, Dave, I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but we sometimes struggle in that we don't necessarily have as much of a carrot there. We do very much have to rely on the stick a lot more. We have to say, if you don't do this, the regulator will come and fine you, and then you'll be in all sorts of trouble, or people bring compensation claims, it'll ruin your reputation, etc. And I think we maybe don't necessarily have the benefit of being able to say, well, actually, if you get on top of this, here's all these, you know, fantastic benefits that you can draw from it, because you can really sort of maximize the value of the data available to you. You mentioned direct marketing a number of times at the start of the session. So that's not to create sort of a rift necessarily between the two sort of conversations here, but I do think it's probably something which is worth recognizing. I suppose that's a way, maybe if you do fold it into your conversations, if you're the DPO, if you say this is something that we need to get on top of, this is potentially an angle through which you could look at it and frame it and say, look, this is one aspect of the conversation in terms of GDPR compliance is accuracy. If we get on top of this, if we prioritize the quality and accuracy of our data, that's going to take us a long way, and there's a lot of benefits we can draw from that. I don't know what my question to you was, Dave. I've sort of lost the train. Sort of trailed off there.
I would kind of agree, but I think it's also about understanding the tools that you got available to you, whether it's data quality or whether it's within particular sectors. I've often looked to, when I'm looking at compliance measures around data protection, especially when they're regulated to social housing side of things, to draw on the fact that the governance and financial viability standards says at paragraph 1.1a, you must comply with all relevant law, and therefore data protection is a relevant law in that sense. I think some of it's actually just understanding the tools that are available to you, and some of those tools may be sector specific, such as ones Colin's mentioned, such as the governance and financial viability standard, and so on and so forth. And it's just knowing how and when to draw on those to support your claim. So if you're the DPO and there's a data inaccuracy issue, then you could draw heavily on a lot of the points that Colin's raised during the session to help highlight how actually data accuracy and the benefits of data accuracy still track back to compliance and still track back to one of the fundamental principles within data protection.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think actually this is a really good point, a little bit of a segue into your final golden rule, Colin, which is a lot of time we talk about. So you mentioned there the idea of tools, Dave, and tools in your arsenal in a broader sense in terms of affecting cultural change, in terms of securing buy-in. But also let's talk more practically about, you know, actual systems, you know, software tools available to you in managing your data. And a lot of the time, we speak about the tools out there for DPOs in terms of managing their ropers, in terms of managing rights requests, all this sort of stuff. And, you know, while I think it's fair to say that for us, the jury's out overall on this, you know, there are products that work, there are products that don't work. There are some which will work better for some organizations than others, because ultimately, you know, there's a number of factors associated with it. I think one of the key things with a lot of this, and more broadly with your compliance exercise, and Colin, this is one of the things that you want to come to, is don't recreate the wheel, right? Sometimes we can be guilty of over-egging it, perhaps, and trying slightly too hard to come up with a novel solution to a problem which is actually one which is shared by all of us, and there are more easily accessible solutions than maybe we think.
For sure. And I'll pass over to Colin in a minute, but I've certainly seen that from people and organizations buying in different bits of kit without necessarily understanding whether what they've got needs configuring properly. So they're buying in different bits of software to help them do bits. Not necessarily seeing that fully from a data accuracy and a data integrity point, but I've certainly seen fancy bits of kit popping up to support InfoSec and DLP tools and things when they've never really possibly considered switching on or configuring DLP within the SharePoint or 365 environment first, in that kind of sense. So sorry about jumping in there, Colin. I'll pass on to you, but I have seen what you're talking about there, Ollie.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a very good point you've just made. For me, there is this saying, isn't there? Plagiarism is the finest compliment, and don't ever underestimate that. You know, don't recreate the wheel. If there is something out there, if you can find out what good looks like, then take your inspiration from it. And going back to your point as well, you know, for me, data protection and data quality are absolutely hand in hand. If you look at the career of a DPO and where you might want to take that role, maybe with time it's to widen the brief so that it includes data quality, which then takes you effectively to becoming a CIO. You know, this sector needs CIOs. It's been slow to start appointing them. There are a growing number within the sector, and there are great opportunities for those that want to explore that. So, I think the two go very, very much hand in hand. So we're looking at not recreating the wheel. So what does good look like? And I mentioned that I facilitated and chaired a group called the Data Quality Group, and the whole idea of this group was to try and create some kind of gold standard for data quality. And actually the group kind of morphed to be more about data maturity than just data quality in the end. Now we looked at various maturity models. Gartner is quite a famous one, but the government was putting their might behind a government quality standard, data quality standard, which the Office of National Statistics was rolling out. And what was quite important about this to us is that they were lobbying the MHCLG, is that it? And the Ministry of Housing, of which the regulator of housing is a part. And so this was likely to be, in our view, the maturity model that was going to be adopted. Now, I can send, if anyone's interested, we can get a link out and email as to what this group found out. But essentially, it came up with a data maturity framework. And within that, the principles that were required, that how you could assess them. And with what was obvious is you every organization to become, if you like, data mature, needed two key elements. And one was accountability. So a CIO or someone that ensured that the data culture within the business was right. So accountability. And the second was the tool, something that could provide you with the background information you needed to have your finger on the pulse, as it were, as to going back to your health checks again, finger of the pulse on the health of data within your business. So we've came away with a kind of a framework, as I say, that had the principles, the assessments and the requirements of the tools. And that, for me, provided you with the basis for going along a scale, if you like, of 1 to 5 in becoming more mature as a data mature as a business. So come back to not recreating the wheel. I think that kind of assessment tool and guide is really what organizations need in order to help them along that route. And come back to it, this is something that the government is trying to introduce, and therefore I think with time it's going to be something that the ICO and the regulator will expect to see.
Very interesting. I mean, I think on that last point in particular, I do support what you're saying there in terms of that becoming an expectation across the housing sector. But I think increasingly, you know, that is the case across other sectors. It's interesting because I suppose this then brings us back to a very early point in this conversation, which is, you know, how far off is the housing sector from the wider conversation on quality and accuracy, and I suppose elements like that maturity of information governance framework. I mean, this is a far bigger conversation, and we certainly don't have time to get into it here. But what you say, that's one of your expectations in terms of the regulator coming to see that as a must-have. But is there anything else that you're predicting, Colin, in terms of changes within the sector? Is this something which is gaining sufficient traction? Is the snowball really sort of gaining momentum, or you know, is that not the case? Am I misinterpreting?
I honestly believe, come back to change, that those within this session are ideally placed to be in probably one of the hottest areas within the sector over the coming few years. Data is going up the agenda. If you look at the risk profile and the risk to organizations, data is right up there now. Every time they produce one of the sector risk profiles, the number of times data is mentioned in it increases. And you just know, again, anyone's welcome to go and look at the, we bore them if they can't sleep at night, go and look at the last 10 years and you'll see, count up the number of mentions of data just increases. And now there is this whole area of data. So I think if and the other challenge the sector's got is holding on to its data people. You know, it's if organizations don't treat data with respect, if it takes data analysts 50% of their time just to get the data in order so they can do some analysis, then they're probably not going to hang around. So, you know, in addressing this, we are going to need people with those skills. And one thing this sector offers that other sectors don't is that social purpose. So if you're going to do it for a bank or a chemical company or something like that, you probably don't feel that your input, your purpose is as great as it might be in social housing, which I believe to have some of the greatest purpose of any sector out there. You know, what other sectors kind of create homes and communities that our children grow up in and therefore provide the foundation stone really for the UK in the future? Teaching maybe is a good one, but you know, hugely important. So if you can make a difference in this sector, you really make a difference to UK PLC. So yeah, I think we're going to see data going up the order. I mentioned the seminar in Scotland this morning. They had the guy from Scotland, he says that they have a data group in Scotland that has over 200 people attend it every month. And maybe there is a need for something like that in social housing. And certainly, I think for those that do embrace it, there is a tremendous opportunity because the organisations in this sector that respect their data, that protect it properly, that ensure the quality is there and they draw the insight from it, those are the organisations that are going to flourish and they will move ahead of their competitors, guaranteed.
And I think that that's really interesting, some of the points that you've raised there. And the bit that kind of stands out for me as well, when you're saying about individuals, business insight that might leave if the information is inaccurate and constantly having to correct inaccurate data in order to start relying on it. It kind of just moves over to a slightly different argument potentially for another day, is the fact that surely inaccurate data isn't a value for money setup if you're looking at, if you're governed by value for money kind of initiatives, because if you're constantly correcting old data and inaccurate data in order to then rely on it to do your reports, then at some point there must be some efficiencies, not necessarily just from looking at do we need the staff and etc, but would it not just be considered a complete waste of time to continually spend resources, time, money, people in that kind of thing, constantly correcting and updating and making sure the information is correct? It wouldn't seem to be a value for money proposition when, if you get it right from the start with all the elements that you've kind of looked and discussed today, then you'd have thought then you're also then potentially meeting your value for money propositions, in the sense that you're doing it properly from the start. You know what I mean, in that sense?
Absolutely. That's what I mean about turning off the dirty data tap. It's all about culture change. It's all about ensuring that people understand that when they're entering data into the system, and growingly, that's customers entering their own information into the system as well. If you've got something that is literally watching the system 24/7, you know, very mundane task, but you know, that's what these kind of tools are for, just watching the system constantly and spotting when irregularities occur, when people have entered a full stop into a text field rather than the full characters required, or something is not in the right format, or whatever it may be, then it will help you to ensure that once you've made those corrections, they stay in place, and those that need a little assistance and development and putting dirty data into the system are identified and supported to get it right in the future. So another reason why these tools are so important.
No, for sure. And I, from my direct marketing days, kind of doing a bit of a circle and back to where we started from a direct marketing days, that would have been an absolute godsend. Because the value of, coming back a bit circular, the value of data, and once you've understood the value and the insight that you can gain from data, you realise just how easily all that's unpicked if the accuracy and the integrity of the data as it's flying around your network, if that's not there, it soon undervalues all of the work there if the information's not accurate. So. Been absolutely fascinating listening to some of the, and I'm sure there's probably lots and lots more that we could to maybe look and focus, because as I indicated earlier, there's maybe many different facets to managing data accuracy and data integrity in that sense. But I found it really interesting anyway.
Look at you, Dave, being disciplined with our time. That's normally we rely on me to rein you in, but that was very diplomatic of you. No, absolutely.
I've been standing in for you too long, Ollie, when you go off on your jollies.
Clearly. All I was going to add was, particularly in respect of your earlier point, Colin, about being able to make a difference in a sector that itself is a big difference maker, I was going to say, is jolly well said on that point. Very much echo that. Before we leave you, there's just the chat has perhaps not been overly busy today, I think, because we've been all so engrossed in listening to you, Colin. But there was a question for you from a fellow Colin Bailey, who asks, just going back to the data maturity assessment we were talking about previously, and what you could foresee as the relevant roles within an organization, particularly if we're talking housing sector, to get that undertaken and completed, whether there's anyone which you already feel like in respect to their role might be earmarked for that, or whether again it's something which needs to be considered and developed out in that sense.
I mean, the key role, to be honest, and the regulator will expect to see it, you know, the regulator states that every board should have the necessary skills required to run the organization properly. Now, you could therefore say, therefore, there needs to be a CIO within every senior team in order for them to be compliant. Now, that doesn't mean they have to employ a CIO. It just means that they have to have access to those skills. So it could be something that could be outsourced. And indeed, I think a great career opportunity for those is not just potentially becoming a CIO later in your career, but also offering your services to various organizations who maybe feel they can't afford a CIO. There are lots of benefits to you know, outsourcing, and I could go through those in greater detail, but I won't do that today. I'd say come back to it. It all starts at the top. It all starts at leadership. So the, I think, fundamental role that's needed within every, certainly medium to large organization, is someone at the very top who is a data expert, both protection and security, and also quality and insight.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Colin. For those of you who are interested, maybe want to find out more, maybe, you know, off the back of this conversation, this is a topic that you'd like to explore further. If you get in touch with us through all the normal channels, we'll put you in touch with Colin and his team. Likewise, you know, if there's any questions in particular that you've got off the back of this that you'd like to ask, just let us know and we can pick those up for you. I know there was some requests for a link to the, you'll have to remind me of the name, Colin, it's the Gartner maturity model, is it?
Yeah, I'll send the output from the group, which is the Gartner maturity, the ONS maturity framework, and also the assessment and tools.
Fabulous. Well, we'll put that out. We'll make it available to all those that are interested. It only leaves for me to thank you ever so much, Colin, for your time, for your insights. It's been really fantastic talking to you. I'm sure I speak for everyone in attendance. Dave, thank you also for joining us this afternoon. Always good to have you with us. And thank you to everyone in attendance. We very much enjoyed this session. It's lovely to have you with us. And we hope to see you all very soon.
No, yeah, well done, Miles. Much. Excellent.
Well done to producer Miles. Excellent. Right. Cheers. Well, on that note, see you all soon. Take care until then, and we'll be back next week with another episode of the podcast. Until then, take care.
Thank you. Take care. All the best, Colin.
All the best. Thank you.